I want today to direct your attention to chapter 5, the Epistle of James, and chapter 5. Let me read first of all the first 6 verses of this chapter. Go to now, you rich men, weep and howl for your miseries that shall come upon you. Your riches are corrupted and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver is cankered, and the rust of them shall be a witness against you, and shall eat your flesh as it were fire. Ye have heaped treasure together for the last days. Behold the hire of the labourers, who have reaped down your fields, which is of you kept back by fraud, crieth. The cries of them which have reaped are entered into the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. Ye have lived in pleasure on the earth, and been wanton. Ye have nourished your hearts as in a day of slaughter. Ye have condemned and killed the just, and he doth not resist you. Now let us consider these verses for a moment or two. You will notice here that the writer is bringing a stinging indictment against the selfish desire to possess the world's riches, even when it means defrauding someone else. It should be clearly understood that riches in themselves are not a crime, and poverty is not a credit. Money in itself is a neutral thing, and is therefore neither evil or good. But the love of money is a root out of which can grow every kind of evil. The possessor of riches could become a great blessing to others if he considered his riches as being a sacred trust from God, and with prayerful exercise he intelligently used his riches in the promotion of the work of God and for supplying the needs of the poor of the flock. The converted rich man was mentioned in chapter 1, and this should teach us that rich men are not excluded from God's salvation. When the Lord Jesus was passing through the city of Jericho, he brought blessing to at least 2 special characters. The one was a poor blind beggar, while the other was a rich tax collector. In chapter 2, much was said about the conspicuous rich man, and the warning given that such a man was not to be treated with preferential consideration. Here in our present study is a rich man who stands to be condemned. In brisk succession we find a number of charges of which this wicked rich man is guilty. The majority of people who read the Bible would be inclined to dismiss this message as not applying to them, because they do not consider themselves included in the category of the rich. However, a careful consideration of the passage will prove that this position cannot be sustained, for while the indictment is levelled against the ultra-rich, and they run the greatest risk of temptation, nevertheless the covetous attitude is not restricted to those who possess the greatest amount of riches, but it can affect all of us. The business of money-making was an important matter in the early days of Christianity, and it is still important and extremely vital in our modern way of life. But let us ever keep in mind that the Christian who makes it his aim to become rich will fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. In the opening verse of the chapter, there is a prophetic warning given to the rich man, where unsparingly and solemnly he is warned of the miseries that are coming upon him. One might be inclined to think that James is contemplating the eternal state when judgment shall be meted out to the unrepentant sinner. But it is obvious that James has something else in mind. A man is not sent to eternal punishment just because he is rich in this world's goods, and no one is given a place in heaven just because he is poor. But whenever a country passes through the experience of social revolution, it is usually the rich who suffer the greatest loss and endure the greatest miseries. In some countries, the revolution meant the overthrow of the monarchy with all of the ruling class and the confiscation of their material goods, while the men themselves were either put to death or sent to work in some labor camp. In other countries, the method was different, but the net result was much similar. The representatives of the working class were voted into power according to the method of democracy, and possessing a majority vote, they decided to take possession of certain businesses which were the property of rich men. And they did this under the name of nationalization. Then, by a system of taxation, they literally robbed the rich and thereby brought upon them untold miseries. Perhaps these miseries began at the destruction of Jerusalem in the year 70. But as this age rushes on toward the end time, the stage is being set for another time of severe hardship, in which the rich will be the greater losers. And so they are warned to weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon them. In verse 2 there is the evil of positive waste, and our attention is directed to the two necessities of life, namely food and raiment. This particular rich man has far more corn than he can possibly use, but instead of sharing it out with the poor and needy and helping to feed the hungry, he stores it up in his barn and it goes to rot. This is the picture of a wealthy man who has an abundance of the fruits of the earth, but decides to keep it all for himself and hoard it in his storehouse, but fails to see that it would all rot and decay. Then our attention is drawn to the subject of clothes to wear. Remember, the Lord described the rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen, which seems to indicate that rich men made a show of their wealth by the robes or outer garments that they wore. We must not make the mistake of thinking that it is wrong to wear good clothes, just because that some other people wear cheap or shabby clothes. But the evil for which these wealthy people were condemned is simply this: they overbought in order to make a great display of their wealth, but were unable to wear all the clothes they possessed, and because they were stored, the moths destroyed them. Far better if the man had shown some compassion for the poor who couldn't afford to buy an outer garment. From the thought of positive waste in connection with food and raiment, we are next directed to the idea of perishing wealth. It is the presentation of a man who made it his business to store up treasures of gold and silver for the last days, and no doubt this man imagined that in his store of wealth there was a great security. But not for a moment had he considered the deception of riches. One may expect gold and silver to become tarnished but not to rust. However, the unexpected thing has happened, and their precious metal treasures have rusted through. Something that is constant use won't rust. But this treasure was not being used, and gradually it fell to pieces with decay. Again, it is possible for one to be deceived by appearances and to imagine that he owns a genuine article and then to realize he only had an imitation. It must come as a tremendous shock for a rich man to suddenly discover that he has become poor. For the Bible says the rust of your treasures will stand like a witness against you. Our study now takes us into the area of personal wickedness and exposes these rich men for what they really were, and shows exactly how they obtained their wealth and the evil practices by which they defrauded other people. At the present time, we hear much about giving because there are so many charitable institutions and religious projects and church organizations who continually appeal for gifts and donations. But seldom do we hear any mention of the fact that God is more concerned with how we obtain our money than with how we give it. In the days when James wrote this epistle, the laboring man was paid his day's wages at the end of each day. But James accuses these covetous landowners of withholding the wages, and the servant had no means of appeal except to cry unto God. Even today, in this so-called enlightened 20th century, there are a number of people who are clever frauds. They know how to make a deal that appears honest, but actually they enrich themselves at the expense of someone else. And to the Christian master, the principle is, masters, give unto your servants that which is just and equal, knowing that ye also have a master in heaven. It is certainly evil to withhold what we should rightfully give to another, but it is doubly sinful to spend it upon ourselves by indulging in luxurious living. That is a solemn charge that is brought against these men that were living in pleasure and paying the price with what rightfully belonged to someone else. The summary then of the charges brought against these people is this. First, they hoarded up their riches, and they wasted and were lost. Second, they obtained the riches by fraud, and were living lives of luxury, and counting this their great pleasure. Now it seems that this wicked man is unaware of the fact that his wealth is his own undoing, for he fattens himself for the day of judgment. This is the picture of the animal that simply eats and looks for more, but is unconscious of the fact that it is being prepared for the day of slaughter. In the days before the flood, men were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, and suddenly the unexpected thing happened, and God took them all away in judgment. The night that King Belshazzar was feasting and drinking without any thought of God, that was the night the enemy entered his stronghold and the king was slain. So this lesson teaches us that God in high heaven takes note of what is going on and moves in his own time. Now let me read a few more verses. I'll read from verse 7 now through verse 12. Be patient therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. Behold, the husbandman waiteth for the precious fruit of the earth, and hath long patience for it, until he receive the early and latter rain. Be ye also patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord draweth nigh. Grudge not one against another, brethren, lest ye be condemned. Behold, the judge standeth before the door. Take, my brethren, the prophets, who have spoken in the name of the Lord, for an example of suffering affliction and of patience. Behold, we count them happy which endure. Ye have heard of the patience of Job, and have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very pitiful and of tender mercy. But above all, my brethren, swear not, neither by heaven, neither by the earth, neither by any other oath. But let your yea be yea, and your nay, nay, lest ye fall into condemnation. Now, you will remember that in chapter 1 it was made perfectly clear that the genuine Christian would have his faith put to the test. But then in these verses we are directed to a very particular area of trial. As this age advances, the pressures and problems become more acute because of the power structure between capital and labor. The Christian who desires to act correctly before God and his fellow man finds himself in a moral traffic jam, hardly knowing which direction to take. When a Christian finds himself the victim of oppression under the hand of his employer, there is a tendency to complain and protest and even rebel at the treatment received. And one has to pass through the experience of being defrauded in regard to wages to know in some little measure how easy it is to fall into the attitude of desiring judgment upon the oppressor. This epistle of James advocates that genuine belief will always prove itself by genuine behavior. And if this was necessary during the first generation of Christianity, we must accept this as an abiding principle and extremely relevant to this 20th century with all its difficulties and confusion. One of the problems that the Christian has to face in this, what is his role in the midst of a society where there are obvious social injustices? If he is the victim, should he fight for his rights? or suffer in silence. If he is not the victim, but is aware of others being victimized and discriminated against, should he enter the political war and endeavor to change the social conditions and the working agreements with a view to making the world a better place? Many well-meaning Christian gentlemen have been led astray on this very issue and have found themselves spending endless hours and energy at a thankless task and seeing no visible benefits from their labor. Now, as the Christian faces such problems and confesses his own weakness and inability to stem the tide of evil or alter in any way the confused conditions of the world, it is right here when the message of this lesson meets our need and sets before us a prospect to encourage, and the Christian's prospect is the coming of the Lord. Now, while James does not enter into a doctrinal exposition of this great truth concerning the second advent of Christ, nevertheless, he sets the truth before us as an accepted fact and applies it in a practical manner to everyday Christian living, with a special message for the distressed or distracted Christian. Unfortunately, the prospect of the return of the Lord has been so distorted by certain schools of theology that the encouragement which it should bring to the Christians has been almost lost, and many of God's dear children will not even study or discuss this great prospect, which is the hope of the Christian, and thus they lose the encouragement that such a doctrine is meant to give. By a careful study of the New Testament, one will arrive at the conclusion that the Lord must return to this earth in order to keep his promises, for he did promise to come again. Then he must return in order to fulfill the prophecies, and he must return in order to complete his purposes. God has purposes for the church, and purposes for Israel as a nation, and purposes for the Gentile nations. However, the important matter in today's lesson is to understand the practical implications of such a tremendous truth and its effect upon the Christian when passing through times of trial. The writers of the New Testament are very careful to apply this truth to practical Christian living, and Paul would have us walk as children of the day, that is, we should be alert and prepared. Peter outlines the startling events at the end time, but calms our hearts and tells us to make sure that when the Lord returns we shall be found in peace. John teaches that everyone who has this hope will live in moral purity. James agrees with these sentiments and he says, be patient. James presses another important factor and shows that it will be necessary for the Christian to exercise long patience. Because of our human imperfections, there is always the tendency to do things in a hurry and thereby seek to short-circuit the plans and workings of God. But we must learn that God's way is the best way, and therefore we should keep ourselves under strict control and exercise patience till God accomplishes his purposes. Moses beheld the sufferings of his brethren down in Egypt and decided that he should do something to relieve the situation. But unfortunately, he didn't wait God's time and placed himself in jeopardy because of his rash action. Then it took 40 years for Moses to learn the lesson in patience. James now takes an illustration from the farmer and shows that there is a time for the farmer to plow and a time to reap. But in all his labor, he must work according to the divine principles and depend upon God giving the early and latter rains, and ultimately the farmer enjoys the fruits of harvest at the end of the season. From the example of the farmer, we should learn this lesson that God expects us to labor on and wait God's time for the results. Remember, the farmer must exercise a lot of patience, and must we do the same? It seems a long time since God announced that the serpent would be crushed and defeated, but that prediction will yet be carried into effect. It is now over 1900 years since the Lord promised that he would return, and someday he will keep that promise. But let us remember that God is not in a hurry, but is long-suffering. Therefore, Christians who profess to be waiting for the return of the Lord should also display the same long patience. Don't be slipping from the path of faith and hope, but get your feet planted with steadfastness. Keep your heart well established, because the coming of the Lord draweth nigh. And when he comes, everything will be properly evaluated and adjusted. In case the Christians should think that they were passing through some kind of exclusive experience and being called upon to express patience beyond the call of duty, we are asked to consider the Old Testament prophets. These men were raised up by God and sent to declare the message of God at a time when things were evil. The people respected not the principles of God. Even although these prophets spoke with authority in the name of the Lord, they were rejected and despised, and their message refused by the majority of the people. These prophets suffered affliction, but they exercised long patience, and you count them happy that endured. If these things be so, then you are in the line of a goodly succession, and you also can commit your way unto the Lord. Now there is brought into focus one outstanding character from the Old Testament as a pattern for our example of one who endured great affliction. Job was a man who passed through a great variety of severe trials. No one seemed to understand why. He lost all of his material possessions at the hands of his enemies, which meant for him a great trial of distress. And then suddenly, without any warning, he lost all his children, sons and daughters, in a disaster. This was the trial of death, when bereavement can rend the heart. Then Job lost his health, passed through the trial of suffering disease. Added to these was the trial of disappointment, when his wife and his supposed friends suggested that he was hiding some secret sin. Job was left all alone in the midst of his misery and suffering, but he committed his way unto the Lord and endured, and in the end he was better off than he was at the beginning. Now the interesting thing in his life and experience was the battle that was being fought behind the scenes, when Satan was seeking to overthrow the faith of Job. But God had everything under control, and Job endured and came out triumphant. Now, says James, take this man for example, and he gives us a practical exhortation. When passing through the experience of bitter trials, a man has a tendency to lose control of himself and begin to use strong language with meaningless oaths and curses. Now, swearing is a senseless habit because it does not give emphasis to the thing uttered and does not raise the speaker in the estimation of the hearer. We are more susceptible to use strong language when we are being oppressed. But the Bible exhorts us not to fall into this error, but keep our language simple and to the point, so that we will not sin with our lips. So just let your answer be a simple yes or no. So you see again, I remind you that James is very, very practical in the things he's writing here in this epistle. In our next study, we shall seek to complete chapter 5 and thus bring us to the end of our considerations of the Epistle of James.